there's a lot of examples, even kind of in Web2 today, like you connect your Fitbit to your John Hancock life insurance policy and you can get a big discount. Well, is that so wrong that John Hancock wants that data in order to give you a big discount? Like, that seems like a pretty good win-win. It's just kind of hard to make happen in Web2.
Hello, welcome to another episode of Unchained Medley. That was Denny Zuckerman. Denny is a co-founder of 3Bucks Labs, a company whose mission is to transform the web's relationship with data. 3Bucks Labs creates software for a more open, safe, and collaborative web. Their identity and data infrastructure is already being used by some of the world's most ambitious Web3 applications. In this episode, we discuss the importance of self-sovereign identity and identity management, what Web3 offers, why self-sovereign identity is the key to unlocking online innovation that wasn't previously possible. We also talked about reputation building, whether privacy and decentralized identity can coexist. Denny also shares what drew him to blockchain, as well as what he and his team at 3Bucks Labs are building. I've always thought of identity and identity management as an understated and potentially hero use case of the blockchain, and Denny's knowledge and insights have bolstered that perspective even further. I learned a lot. I really enjoyed the conversation with Denny. I'm sure you will too. Without further ado, here's Denny. Hey, Denny. Welcome to the Unchained Medley podcast. Thank you for joining today.
Thanks for having me. Excited for this conversation.
Yeah, same here. I just want to start off by talking a little bit more about your background and how you found your way working into blockchain, just so our audience has an idea of who you are.
Yeah, of course. So it was a winding journey, but I've been fascinated for a long time with how people work together. Started with being obsessed with The West Wing growing up, my favorite TV show. When I got to college, I tried a whole bunch of things, and what caught me was political philosophy, the study of how people work together at societal or even cross-societal scales. After college, didn't know what I wanted to do, ended up at Bain & Company doing consulting. And what I found most interesting there was org design and governance cases, which I ended up doing a lot of, mostly for big tech companies. And when I moved on from there, joined a small startup building products. But what I actually found more interesting than building the products was building the teams and getting teams to work together effectively. And in 2016, I decided to travel and read for a while. And among the things that I read was try to figure out what the hell this blockchain thing was. And the more I read about it, the more pieces started to fall into place. And ultimately, it hit me that this was the best technology we've ever had for coordinating people at different scales and in different ways really efficiently. So that was what hooked me. And as soon as it did, I started exploring the space more. It was very early in kind of the application stack at the time. But there were some projects like Aragon and Colony and others who were working on some of the ideas around how can we create coordination tooling based on this technology. And so ended up working more in the identity and data primitive area, which we can talk about. But it was this idea of blockchains as this coordination technology that brought me in.
Gotcha. I was doing some research prior to this call, and I noticed that I think in one of the interviews you had, you had mentioned that you'd heard about blockchain a while back, but you kind of ignored it because you just thought it was a lot of noise, typical of like Silicon Valley sometimes. And it's cool to hear you how you found your way back into it. But I'm curious, when you first heard about it initially, what was it about how it was sort of narrated that maybe turned you off?
It's a good question. I'm not sure it had anything to do with the narrative around it and more just where I was and how I was receiving it. I had lived in the Bay Area for 25 years in San Francisco for three of them. And I had, at that point in my life, just happened to be a little bit overwhelmed by the kind of overwhelming tech-centricity of Silicon Valley and San Francisco, and was used to hearing the new buzz. And at the time, it was like when everything was local, social, and mobile, I guess a little SOMO. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of heard Bitcoin blockchain as this new thing that people in SF were obsessed with, but nobody else cared. And so I just rejected it out of hand. I did none of the work to really understand what was exciting about it and why people were excited about it. And so it was only once I did, several years later, that I was able to kind of meet the technology and the possibility where it was.
You know, I always think it's interesting to see how people eventually sort of go from maybe a little bit of skepticism to believers. I'm not sure where I stand on that spectrum, but I'm hoping conversations like this help me sort of figure it out. Let's go into identity management now. I think just for our audience, it'd be good to sort of explain what is identity management, how do you define it? And when we think about
the current sort of world we live in, which is defined now as Web 2, how do you think it evolves between the status quo now and where it's going to go in the future? And so let's just start with what identity management is.
Yeah, so identity is one of these terms that no matter the context, just is so loaded. It has so many potential connotations and contexts. And so it is worth pausing to define it. So
yes.
Identity management, if you say that, you'll often have people in the tech world think about like enterprise identity management, basically access controlling what data goes with what identifier, what person or login online, and then who has access to various parts of it. More broadly, identity in Web 2 is, it's a bunch of different things, but it's the managing of information attached to different identifiers. And the way that that works right now is applications run databases on their own server that they maintained, and they have what's called a user table. It's a really simple database with basically rows for each user that they serve, basically everyone who has a login, and then columns for the different data associated with that user, your profile name, your email address. Maybe it's a pointer to another database with all of the clicks you've ever made on their site, or calls to other external databases so that they can triangulate KYC information or something else. But these user tables on databases are how applications on Web 2 manage their user base. And us as users, when we come to these applications, have to play by those rules and conform to that infrastructure, which means every time we go to a new application, we log into their accounts and they go look us up on their table, their user table. And so it's this very fragmented, very application-centric, very siloed, and very redundant model for user identity and therefore for user data. And we've just gotten used to that. And people are used to complaining about their passwords, but it's more than just logins and passwords. It's all of this data and information is reproduced for every single application we go to and managed by them, potentially insecurely, potentially in counterproductive ways, potentially in ways that are abusing our data and information. But we really have had no say in that. And so that's kind of the state of things in Web 2 today.
No, that makes total sense. And I think you talked a little bit about why that is broken, but for somebody who's just saying like, well, it works fine today, what does Web3 bring to the table that we didn't have before?
Yeah, so I think that it's possible to say it works fine today. Now, increasingly, that won't be the case. And it's not just the reports of Facebook abusing user data or security breaches. These are the tip of the iceberg. I think more and more as we're contending with fake news, with data hacks, which are becoming more common, like actually, very intentional, very sophisticated hacks from external actors, but also things like deepfakes. Like, we have no ability to actually trust these systems of record run by applications, which we've had to date. But as these breaches become more common, who's to say the bank or the application didn't forge, history, and who's maintaining that? The bigger deal, though, is those negative stories are really only the tip of the iceberg. The much bigger deal, which we don't feel as acutely, is all of the innovation that isn't happening because our identities and data are siloed and controlled by these applications and especially by a few big platforms. What that means is we've got a platform like Facebook who has this extremely valuable user table. Basically, all the users who have Facebook accounts, all of their friends, the social graph, all this data, and they control that. And that has become this really important infrastructure for the web that lots of other applications draw on too. But that means that Facebook basically has this massive advantage over anyone else who wants to do anything in the realm of what Facebook does from a product perspective, which means they have this huge advantage and they get to choose who gets to build on this database. And so what you have is a massive reduction in the amount of innovation that can happen on the web, because most developers can't compete with Facebook. Most applications can't get built. So this idea of permissioned innovation is actually much more sizable than, the stories we hear about data breaches. It's actually like the fact that this data is locked off is creating the silent killer of a lack of innovation online. And so very long lead into what Web3 offers is permissionless innovation, the ability for anybody to build on top of the same data sets and the same shared decentralized network of users and data, so that we unlock all of this innovation and you don't have a few people and a few corporations gatekeeping what can get built and what can compete. And the way that that works is instead of every application running their own database with their own user table, you have all applications operating on the same decentralized data network to construct this shared user table around which all this data gets aggregated and each user has control of their own data. And so we can talk much more about what that looks like, but that is the basic idea, is to invert this model to a shared user-centric model for data and identity online.
Gotcha. No, thank you for explaining. And yeah, I'd love to talk a little bit more about what that looks like. Can you just sort of walk me through what that would look like in practicality?
Sure. So let's start with like what blockchains have done to date, because it might be a helpful anchoring point.
Okay.
Blockchains are decentralized networks that store a very specific type of data in a way that everybody can audit, like kind of look at the blockchain and see the record and trust because of the math and the game theory and the incentives that all the participants in the network are playing by. Instead of trusting a third party maintaining a database, you're trusting a network of people who are incentivized to keep this database in a single trusted state. Now, blockchains are for a very specific type of data. They're for like value data, financial data. So these are like assets, whether those are fungible tokens or non-fungible tokens, contracts. And these are things where you need very specific properties to keep track of these pieces of information. But the same concept of a public state network can be applied to any kind of data online, a list of users or other data associated with them. And so that's basically what we're building at Ceramic Network, one of the projects that I work on and helps create, is this decentralized network for persisting arbitrary data that isn't value data, that is just any kind of data online. And the way that it works is you have a decentralized set of participants running nodes in the network. So like a blockchain, you have these nodes that are persisting this information. And on Ceramic, what they're persisting are these streams of data, basically these data objects that can hold any set of updates to a piece of data. And each piece of data is authored by a self-sovereign user identity called a DID. And basically, this is a way to have these, instead of, again, you know, rows in a table on a database that an application controls, the DID is controlled directly by the user through their different wallets and blockchain accounts. They can link multiple to it. So it's much more user-friendly and flexible than a typical blockchain account. But they're directly writing this information into these streams of data, which are then persisted on a decentralized network. So that's the basis. And on top of that really, really like primitive data structure, you can construct things to organize this data in very specific ways, including like a decentralized user table where you keep an index of all of the user's data, no matter where it's stored, no matter where it comes from. So again, you're organizing data around the user and the application.
Ah, okay. I see then. So in that case, then I know you've talked a little bit about composable data, like the idea that information or data is portable enough to be like reused or read by various applications. And that is sort of in contrast to what we have to do, where there's a centralized server that stores all your information. So is the Ceramic Network, are you enabling that to happen? Or I'm just trying to figure out, is Ceramic Network still a centralized database here? Or is it just a protocol involved in passing data between various applications?
Yeah, so it's definitely not centralized. So again, the protocol itself can be run by anyone. And if they're running a kind of a node in the protocol, they're part of this network. So no one party, including 3Box Labs, my company, has governance or control over the network, the protocol, or the data on it. And because of this, there's no lock-in, right? Like anyone can build an application and any user can use those applications, and that data is going to be stored on some set of these nodes, but anyone else can run a node and start to persist that data too. And it can always be moved to other networks as well. And so you don't have the lock-in that you have with a centralized database. And because of that, you can kind of trust and build on top of this data. And as another application, a third-party application who didn't, you know, necessarily participate in saving that data in the first place, you could come in and build on Ceramic. And then if I, as a user, come to this new third-party application, I bring with me all of the data that I've created and accrued with, you know, all the other applications that I've used. And so that's the data composability, is that these different apps get to leverage and build on the same underlying data because it's on the shared open network.
Gotcha. That makes sense. So when you think about the actual content of the data itself, then does any one party besides the owner, do you have access to it, or do I have to give you access to that? Are you able to verify it, for example, with the zero knowledge proof without actually having access to the content of the data?
Yeah. So every piece of data on Ceramic and every update to the data on Ceramic is signed by the DID of the controller. We call it controller rather than owner because ownership's kind of a messy concept when it comes to something like data. So every stream has a controller, which is usually the user, and they sign every update. And those updates could be public or they could be, like the content can be public or can be private. And right now the implementation is fairly naive, public or encrypted. In the future, though, you'll be able to use things like you mentioned, like zero knowledge proofs, to be able to disclose kind of proofs of what's in the content without actually sharing the content itself. That's something for the future. But the core concept is, yeah, users or controllers of the data get to choose who has access to that data and who doesn't. And so you can bring your data with you from app to app, but you actually get to more granularly choose, you know, I want app A to see this set of information and app B to see all of my information, or app C to see just this, you know, my gaming data, for example. And so it's really up to the user what they want to disclose and when.
Yeah, that's right. That makes a lot of sense. Some of the things I was thinking about as you were just talking about how a user is able to grant access to data to various applications. Like, I do wonder, is it possible, and maybe this is just me being a little bit more cynical here, where I only give you access to A, B, and C for an application, but in order to see maybe some more information on that application, I have to give you some more data. So for example, let's say I'm on Facebook and I say, I give you my picture and my name. And then they're like, yeah, that's fine, but we're going to limit whatever you can do with this application because you gave me that data. And then for you to get full use of it, then we want like your entire life story. You think that's like a possibility out of that? Or is that a little bit too just cynical in thinking about it?
I think that's a very strong possibility, but I wouldn't be so cynical about that. I think it's pretty reasonable for applications to ask for more data to deliver more services. And one of the really interesting things about when you flip the model of how data is managed is that you're giving kind of governance over data flows to users. And because of that, you really change the incentives around applications and what they want to do with data. Instead of trying to hoard data, now what they really want to do is earn your trust to get more access to that data, because you can always revoke it and take away all their future access. So, you know, there's a lot of examples even kind of in Web2 today. Like, you connect your Fitbit to your John Hancock life insurance policy and you can get a big discount. Well, is that so wrong that John Hancock wants that data in order to give you a big discount? Like, that seems like a pretty good win-win. It's just kind of hard to make happen in Web2 because all these data sources are so fragmented. In Web3, I'll very happily give access to certain trusted applications to have a lot of my data, at least temporarily, in exchange for discounts or in exchange for better products or better services, or even sometimes in exchange for better ad targeting so that what I'm seeing on the page is at least more relevant to me. That's a win-win. And applications can know that if they abuse that data, if they copy it or share it, I'm never going to give them access again, and they're going to be cut off in the future because ultimately I have the governance over my own data. And so I think that your anticipation of what might happen is right, but I actually think that opens up a huge new set of possibilities for creating value out of data with more kind of more informed governance over how that data is used.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Thanks for clarifying. And then switching gears now to thinking about reputation and reputation building, I kind of see the argument about reputation for like an owner of the identity, like the individual. But there's also, to what you mentioned earlier, trusted apps. Like, they also have to have reputation for me to grant them access. So when you think about decentralized identity, how do I think about reputation?
So if you think about reputation, what it really is, different aggregations and abstractions on top of data, whether that's a whole bunch of ratings or a bunch of your financial histories combined into a credit score. Like, these different kinds of reputations are just putting data together in different ways for different contexts. So in a world in which we are building on this user-centric shared data infrastructure, as a user, you have all this data aggregating around you all the time. And that creates the possibilities for really, really sophisticated and rich reputations, but it doesn't mean that all data needs to play into all reputations all the time. And so you have all this data around you, it's all signed, so it's verifiable where it's coming from and that it's valid. And so you might have a whole bunch of data that you use for a social app and they might be drawing on a whole bunch of social data, like who has liked your posts and what topics are you interested in and do you know about. And that's one form of reputation. And they might be able to draw on not just the data from kind of that one application, but all your other relevant you know, social experiences, because again, this data is aggregating around you and you have this portability over it. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be drawing on your financial data for this social application. And it doesn't mean you need to be granting access to that financial data for that social application. And so the thing that I think is the kind of the right principle is give users the ability to bring their data with them across contexts and then make it easy for applications to request data and build different reputation systems on top of it, but give users ultimate control over, you know, which of those data are brought to bear. And so I think what we'll see long term is like reputations as a service, different algorithms that pull on different data in different ways that applications at the interface layer can try to make use of it and use.
Gotcha. Yeah, it sounds similar to like, I think I read like China has like this social credit score system or something. I can totally see this being like a combination of that plus your credit score. And I don't know, maybe seeing where we go with that.
Yeah, I hope we avoid that. I think that the China system is kind of the nightmare scenario, because in that case, it's, you know, it's centralized, it's one entity. And therefore, like, users actually don't have the ability to opt in and opt out. It's this universal reputation mm-hmm. system that is putting everybody basically on trial all the time. And so that's why I think it's so important to be aware that reputation is really contextual. Like, what I do in a financial transaction has no bearing with how I behave on Reddit,
really has no bearing with
how good an Uber driver or rider I am. And so the China system is basically forcing users into this, you know, surveillance state where everything is being added to like how good a citizen they are. And I won't pretend to be an expert on the China system, but like that is, you know, surveillance, not just capitalism, surveillance state. And we want to avoid that. Like a universal reputation is a really nightmare scenario. But universal portability of data to deploy to really contextual reputations, that's really powerful. And it's very different because now you're using the right data for the context to make good determinations. And I think that leads to very different experiences for the users and for the internet we'd be creating.
Yeah, thank you. No, I definitely agree. I would like to avoid a universal reputation scheme. That is very nightmarish. Switching gears now to thinking about privacy. So in this case then, like if you think about decentralized identity, is it an oxymoron to also talk about privacy, or can those two things exist? Or maybe there's some coexistence partially there, or how do I think about privacy here?
Yeah, it's tricky. And I think how to think about it is probably the right question and starting point. There's ways in which it compromises privacy and there's ways in which it massively improves privacy. And so I think that there's so much built into the privacy narrative and conversation today, it's useful to like pull apart what we're actually after here. So if your goal around privacy is the ability for any person online or actor online to not have any of their information disclosed or known to anybody, this is not going to help that, because you are storing this data on a public network, on a shared network. You're storing it on a more open infrastructure than a private database. Therefore, more information, even if it's encrypted and protected in various ways, is being leaked and fingerprinted. And so from the concept of privacy as the ability to completely hide yourself, this is going to compromise that. But that's not really what most people want when they talk about privacy. That's kind of that's like the hammer approach, the very blunt approach, is just hide everything. Most people, when they talk about privacy, what they really want in different contexts is what we talked about earlier, like governance over their data, choice about who has access to their data, to know that Facebook isn't, you know, selling your data, that the apps that you use aren't letting your data be hacked and shared all over the place. And so in that context, to have data organized around users, encrypted by them, and access controlled by them is a huge improvement in the ability for users to determine who has access to their data when. And so that massively improves a lot of the issues impacted in the narrative around privacy. It improves the ability to share data with multiple parties without there being a whole bunch of hack together kind of third-party solutions. So imagine like your medical data. You use multiple hospital systems and now they have to share your medical data between them. That is a massive opportunity for privacy to be compromised if they're not using really good protocols, not really good security. And there needs to be a massive kind of bureaucracy and workflows around enabling that, because it's two other third-party organizations sharing data about you. Well, in a user-centric world, they don't do that. one hospital system saves data with you, and you just bring it with you to the other, and it's all going through you and through your governance. And so, again, I think it really kind of matters what we want when we talk about privacy. Is it the ability to hide from the world, or is it the ability to have some control over our data? And that really determines kind of whether these systems help or hurt the cause, or some combination of the two.
But going back to that medical data example then, like, what if I argue that you could do that in Web 2 today, right? Somebody could give you access to your own data, and then when you go into a different hospital, you could bring that data with you and give that hospital access to your data. I guess in that particular example, I'm trying to see, is that governance case, is that the main benefit of Web 3?
Yeah, so APIs in Web 2 give applications the ability to expose that data, but it's not with the control of the user. I mean, the applications might decide to give consent to the user, but technologically, third parties are the ones controlling this data. And there's you have to trust them that they're controlling it in the way that you want them to. It's also just far less elegant to have, many, many different connections between, so we're talking about medical data, might not be as obvious, but talk about, like, if you look at the pipeline of data sharing and the industry around data sharing for advertising and marketing, your personal data is being shared dozens of times per second every time you go to a new website. And it's just, like, in addition to compromising privacy, extremely ineffective, because they're having to triangulate lots of different factors and identities and pieces of data to try to make a best guess about who you are, and delivering sometimes what feels like very creepy information. And so, like, over 15 years of the MarTech industry, like, making a lot of money for this, they've gotten creepily good at times. But that doesn't mean it's efficient and overall effective, and it's definitely compromising people's privacy all over the place.
Okay, that helps. Thanks for that explanation. A question or a thought that comes to mind that when I think about user governance is around convenience. We all sort of know that the average person values convenience over anything else. So just right now, when you think about, I have to sort of manage all my data and figure out who I give it to, I'm guessing eventually technology will evolve to a place where it's a little bit easier. But I do wonder about how burdensome that is to the user to have to give access or control what data can be seen by whom. And is there, like, an elegant solution around that for the user, or how should I think about that?
There's definitely a set of challenges ahead around keeping it both secure and a good UX for users. But it doesn't have to be granting access to every app for every piece of data. Users might have policies that say if this app is, trusted according to some metric, then they grant them access to this set of data. Users might grant data governance rights to DAOs or to centralized companies who are making those decisions and basically acting on watchdogs of who's trusted and who's not. And so users will be able to get, users kind of have fine-grained control and choice, but there's ways for them to, and for apps, kind of abstract up from that and not have to be quite so granular and direct with every single thing, but rather write rules, policies. The vision of many is kind of granting kind of agents or these kind of smart AI-driven pieces of software that make choices about who to grant what data. And so I think we're pretty far from that, although maybe not as far as it sounds. But just because we have the ability to be super granular doesn't mean every user has to be. And different users will make different trade-offs about how much control they want to have day-to-day versus how much they want to trust these other systems and policies and rules.
Gotcha. I've always sort of thought about, identity and identity management as the hero use case for blockchain. I know we talk about NFTs and finance and DeFi stuff, and that seems to be more interesting and more exciting and, for lack of a better word, sexier. But I am wondering, though, like, what else do you think needs to change for this use case to be more known or more talked about? I feel like it's a very underserved use case. Where do you think the struggles are, and how do you think that ecosystem needs to evolve?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's less maybe sexy than the others are talked about for two reasons. One, the tech is still just being developed and just coming online. So Ceramic is really the first protocol to deliver on some of these ideas. But the other is it's not targeting mainstream users. NFTs, DeFi, these are things that anybody can go use. And the customer of the product is anybody. That's not true for new data infrastructure. The customer of new data infrastructure is developers. And so if you talk to Web3 developers, people building applications in this space, I think they're just as excited about this as NFTs or DeFi, but that's just a smaller subgroup compared to every user out there. And so I think that's what's driving the difference in noise and buzz.
There's one question I actually forgot to ask you earlier is the concept of wallets and how we use wallets as a way to give access and grant access to various applications for whatever reason. Do you think that that's how we're always going to manage our identity? Or do you think like eventually it's going to evolve to something else?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that the concept of wallets to manage cryptographic keys is really important. I think the UX of them will change, and I think they'll be embedded deeply into our phones and devices and browsers. And so the way that they show up and work might be very different. You know, we've taken a different approach than many in the space. We've chosen to make an identity system that uses any wallet and any key and kind of works with it. And so you can use any blockchain account with any wallet to manage data on Ceramic. A lot of others who are kind of building identity solutions in the space have a concept of kind of a standalone identity wallet. We think that's kind of unnecessarily high friction and creates distance between these two concepts of financial rails and data rails. But, you know, that is something that others are building. And so I think we have a lot of iteration to go as a space before we kind of end on the full UX and experience for Web3 and especially kind of metaverse type applications built on Web3. So I think it's pretty hard to guess at where that's going to end up, especially since I don't spend most of my time thinking about that layer.
So then talking about your company, Threebucks Labs, what is it that your company is doing and what are you doing to evolve this space? You mentioned Ceramic Networks. I know you also have IDX, but just give us an overview of what Threebucks Labs is.
Yeah, so we are basically trying to bring all these concepts to life by building the decentralized identity and data infrastructure that Web3 developers need to build fully featured rich applications that benefit from a decentralized stack, from censorship resistance and composability and trust and this permissionless innovation that comes with all of that. And so the way that we've been doing that is building this developer infrastructure and tooling kind of in different ways over time. That started with an SDK that made these concepts really easy to use in kind of a subscale way and had about 1,000 applications in the Ethereum ecosystem build on that SDK. It was like a decentralized Firebase, and that kind of taught us what we needed to know to build the protocol that we think will really make this usable for every dev across Web3, and that's Ceramic Network, which you and I have both referenced. And so Ceramic Network is basically the data rails for Web3 applications, the way that blockchains are the financial rails. And so it is this protocol for managing dynamic information in a completely self-sovereign way, where each user is in control of their own data on a permissionless, decentralized, shared data infrastructure and network. And so it's on a limited mainnet right now, a completely open and permissionless testnet. Dozens of apps are live, hundreds are building on it. And so we've still kind of stayed a little bit under the radar because we're really making sure that it has the performance and reliability and kind of full set of use cases and security that apps need as they go live before we kind of scale and go big. But that will change pretty early in 2022.
Can you talk about, if it's public knowledge, some of the companies or apps that are building on Ceramic Networks and just give examples of what they are and what they do?
Sure. I can talk about a few different ones. One of the really common use cases for Ceramic is to manage what you talked about earlier, this kind of cross-identity and cross-account reputation. And so one that went live recently is Rabbit Hole, which is doing pretty amazing work onboarding new users into Web3. And to do that, Rabbit Hole is this concept of skills, these credentials that you can get to kind of show that you've learned something and therefore are qualified for the different quests that they have. Those credentials need to be stored somewhere. And so Rabbit Hole is storing those credentials on Ceramic attached to your identity. And so this reputation is a really popular one. Another really popular use case is for user-generated content, posts, comments, proposals, chat. All of these things need to be stored somewhere. It can't really store it on a blockchain. And if you store it on a server, you're kind of compromising all the properties we talked about earlier. And so a bunch of projects are using Ceramic to manage this social content. One example is Boardroom, who released this ideation feature for governance for DAOs. Another example is a project that actually just came out. We had kind of didn't even know it was being built, called Orbis. Someone in the community has built this decentralized Twitter clone that they're constantly adding new features to and innovating very quickly on top of. And all the content is on a combination of Ceramic for the kind of live application and user data content, and then Arweave for long-term storage. So those are a couple of the examples. There's a bunch more, but I'll pause there for now.
Yeah, those are all three compelling examples. I'm familiar with a couple of them, but we'll go read up on Orbis after this. I'm actually just curious, what's the business model for these apps that are building on top of Ceramic? Is it similar to an API model or is it something different?
Well, for each app has their own business model. Some have tokens, some have API.
Oh, I meant for you guys, Ceramic.
So right now, Ceramic is similar to, it's a peer-to-peer network, so we can run a node. There will be hosted nodes on Ceramic that companies that want to host infrastructure for others can do. In the long run, though, Ceramic will have its own token to power certain parts of the network. We'll be sharing more about that in the new year. But that's long-term how we make sure that the network is sustainable and all the participants have both, you know, guaranteed persistence and availability of the data they're saving there and can rely on in a fully decentralized way, as well as making the network itself economically sustainable.
Thank you. This has been really helpful. Is there anything else that you'd like our audience to know? Just any questions I should have asked or any additional information around identity and identity management that you think is key here?
No, I think the big thing is just like how powerful this is, not just to eliminate some of the harms we hear about in Web2, but to just unlock so much more rapid innovation and so much more of a level playing field online. And so if you're a developer, I'd encourage you to start hacking. Like, you can't really understand the power of this until you try it and use it. And as a user, look out for the use cases where you'd love to have your data be portable and more useful, because I think, you know, we don't quite know exactly what use cases are going to make this really take off first. And it's always interesting to be on the lookout for which ones most benefit from this model and will help us as an ecosystem really gain steam.
Okay. What are some of your recommended resources for someone who's interested in this space to learn more? I'm guessing we'll start with 3Bucks Labs, but just curious if you have any other resources.
Yeah. Oh man, so many. What got me into the space was reading, but it wasn't any one thing. I think that this hits, it's a rabbit hole. It's never ending and it hits everybody differently. And so I'd recommend, like, honestly, as cliche as it is, like, start following, you know, groups of people on Twitter that resonate with you, and then see who they retweet and who they follow, because the space changes so fast and there's more and more kind of overall primers on Web3 and different concepts out there now. But I wouldn't kind of, you know, pick and choose from different places and hear different voices. Forefront is a really great, you know, Forefront DAO is doing a great job curating content. So if I was going to send people one place, that might be it. Watch for what Developer DAO is doing. It's a DAO of developers that are creating really cool new things. Of course, you can find what we're doing on Twitter at Ceramic Network, or in our Discord chat.ceramic.network. I'm at DAZUCK on Twitter and share out things every so often. But I really think it's just diving into communities and including the crypto Twitter community and finding the stuff that resonates and chasing that.
Yeah, that's really helpful. I definitely agree. I found myself just scrolling a lot through Twitter and Discord. There's a lot of information. It's very hard to keep up, but I still think it's the best way to learn for sure. How can people find you? What's the best way to connect with you? Is it Twitter? Is there some other way to connect with you?
Yeah, Twitter at DAZUCK is probably
awesome.
Best.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Danny. I really enjoyed talking to you. I learned quite a bit and I really am super grateful for your time today.
Of course, this was fun. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm your host, Lyde. Until next time.